Good morning. I call this meeting of the House Education Committee to order. Today is Monday, March 16th, and the time is, looks like, 8:13 a.m. A little bit of a delay while we got things together this morning. Happy Monday morning. Members present are Representative Elam, Representative Dibert, Representative Schwanke, Representative Eichscheid, Representative Underwood, Co-Chair Story, and myself, Co-Chair Himshut. We have a quorum to conduct business. Please remember to silence your cell phones. We are in the Betty Davis Conference Room 106 in the State Capitol Building here in Juneau, Alaska. The documents for today's meeting have been distributed to members, are available on the table outside the door, and have been uploaded to BASIS. I'd like to thank our recording secretary, Kale Brown, and our moderator from the Juneau LIO, Doug Bridges. Thank you for being here and for your patience this morning. And I also want to thank our committee aide, Ella Lubin, and stepping in from the story office, we have Kaylee Holm. So today's agenda, we had originally planned to do one of our celebrations of excellence in our schools, overlooking the fact that last week was spring break and we were unable to connect with the people that we were hoping to hear from, so we just are going to move that back a week. So apologies for that change in the schedule. We do have House Bill 376 and House Bill 358. We've had several cancellations, and I appreciate the flexibility of the committee and the public. Our first agenda item is House Bill 376 by the House Education Committee, entitled An Act Relating to Early Intervention Services for Certain Children, Relating to Optional Services Under the Medical Assistance Program, and Providing for an Effective Date. This is the first hearing of this bill in its first committee of referral. I'd like to invite Representative Story and staff to please come forward and introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation. Good morning.
Good morning, everyone. It's so good to see you on this snowy day. I would like to introduce myself for the record. I am Representative Andy Story, and I have the pleasure of serving the North Mendenhall Valley, Hawk Bay, Out the Road, Haynes, Skagway, Cleckwin, and Gustavus. So this morning, I also wanted to let members know that I also serve as the legislative liaison to the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. The Council supports this investment in early intervention work with infants and children who show developmental delays in their growth. Members of the Council will be providing invited testimony at the end of my remarks today. I'm joined by my staff member, Kaylee Holm. And today, I do have the pleasure of introducing House Bill 376, Expand Early Intervention Services, on behalf of the House Education Committee. This bill is companion legislation for Senate Bill 178, sponsored by the Senate Health and Social Services Committee. As members of the committee, I know you are all strong advocates for children with developmental delays or disabilities, and I do not need to convince you of the benefits of early intervention. I want to briefly highlight why I believe this legislation is important. Right now, Alaska is on the wrong side of the pay now or pay more later for early intervention services. Approximately 90% of a child's brain development occur before age 3, making the earliest years of life the most critical period for development. When developmental disabilities are identified and addressed during this time, children often need fewer intensive services when they start kindergarten and later in school, and they show better future outcomes. Families are supported to help their children early in the child's life, empowering parents and family members to help their children make developmental improvements. When these delays go unaddressed during this time, families and children experience greater stress and the child shows less progress. And the state frequently ends up paying far more later through special education, health care, and other support services as they go through the public education system. Unfortunately, many young Alaska children with meaningful developmental delays are unable to access services until after this critical stage of development, simply because the state of Alaska and our policy chooses to be one of only 3 states with the most restrictive eligibility standards for early intervention services in the nation. Children need to show a delay of 50% before they are eligible for services, 50%. This prevents children from receiving support when it could have the greatest impact and yield the greatest cost savings when they are younger. This bill before you seeks to improve Alaska's early intervention system in three main ways. The first is the bill amends Alaska's Medicaid statute to add early intervention services to the list of optional services the Department of Health may provide, which positions the state to receive federal Medicaid reimbursement for services that are otherwise funded largely with state dollars. Second, the bill requires the Department of Health to review the conditions that qualify as a disability and make recommendations to the Alaska State Legislature on updating those conditions. This periodic review ensures the program reflects current medical knowledge and best practices. Third, and most importantly, the bill updates Alaska's eligibility criteria for early intervention services. House Bill 376 aligns Alaska's definition more closely with federal standards under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act and lowers the eligibility threshold for services. Under this legislation, children would qualify for services if they demonstrate a 25% developmental delay in one area or 20% developmental delay in two or more developmental areas. Overall, House Bill 376 is about helping children get the support they need at the earliest possible stage, improving long-term outcomes for them and their families while making better use of state and federal resources. With that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, my staff member, Kaylee Holm, will walk you through the bill section analysis and explain how each part helps address the challenges in Alaska's early intervention system. And then we have a presentation on the fiscal note, and then we will have invited testimony this morning. So thank you very much.
That's great. Ms. Holm, could you put your name on record and provide the sectional analysis?
Good morning. For the record, Kaylee Holm, staff member to Representative Andy Story. So I will just quickly go through the sectional analysis. And so the first section adds early intervention services for eligible children to the list of optional services that can provide under Medicaid. This, like the representative said, helps expand intervention services and allows these services currently being funded by the state to be reimbursed through Medicare. And the second section updates the purpose of this section of the Alaska Early Intervention Status. It removes the language allowing services to be provided on a discretionary basis to children who are only considered at risk for developmental delay. This changes the focus of the program to more clearly focus on children that actually have developmental delays and ensuring resources that are directed to the greatest need. Section 3 updates the statute governing how early intervention systems are administered. Section 4 clarifies eligibility for early intervention services. It specifies that children under the age of 3 qualify if they are experiencing a developmental delay or disability. Section 5 addresses individual family service plans, which outlines services a child and family will receive. Section 6 updates the definition of developmentally delayed. It aligns Alaska's definition with the Federal Individual and Disabilities Education Act and allows children with smaller but more meaningful delays to be qualified. Section 7 repeals and enacts the definition of early intervention services to provide a comprehensive list of services that may be provided. Section 8 repeals several outdated sections in the law, including the definition of core and additional in early intervention services, and updates it. Section 9 requires the State Department of Health to submit a report to the legislature by July 1st, 2029. This report must include information on how children need services, how many receive them, and what types of services are provided, program costs, and federal funding. This will help the legislator evaluate how well programs are working to determine whether there's different improvements that are needed. Section 10 directs the Department of Health to amend and submit the state's Medicaid plan to ensure that the changes to this bill can be implemented through the Medicaid system. Section 11 provides Medicaid-related changes in the bill to take effect if the government, federal government approves and amends the state medical plan, and Section 12 and 13 establish the bill's effective date, with the most provisions taking effect July 1st, 2026. All these changes were based on the recommendations of the Alaska Department of Health Interagency Coordination Council, and were some of who are online today. So at this point, I would like to pass it to them.
Thank you for that abbreviated sectional analysis. Very well done. Thank you. So I think we'll go now to Pamela Burton from Department of Health to look at the fiscal note, and then we'll have committee questions after that. So Ms. Burton, could you unmute yourself, put your name on record, and walk us through the fiscal notes for House Bill 376?
Good morning, everyone. And for the record, it is Pamela Burton. I am with the Department of Health.
Ms. Burton, you're breaking up quite a bit. If you're using a speakerphone, it often works better to not use the speaker function and just...
Okay, sorry about that.
Oh, that's way better. Okay, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Okay, sure. I'll start over for the record. My name is Pamela Burton. I am with the Department of Health, Division of Senior and Disability Services, and I am on the line to be available for policy questions. I'm not a fiscal analysis, although I'm happy to talk about what I know about the fiscal notes. There are two fiscal notes. One is representing the additional costs for Medicaid services to add ILP services that are not currently billable. And the second one is an increase to program costs for two additional PCMs to oversee the additional work that would bring.
I think that more or less talks about why we have two different fiscal notes for this bill. So thank you for providing that context. I think at this point we should just go to a couple committee questions, and then we'll move to our invited testimony. So does the committee have questions for the sponsor or for Ms. Burton with the Department of Health? Representative Elam.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing the bill forward. Just curious if there are any other structural dependencies that are needed, or if the bill functions kind of within itself, or I thought I heard there was some federal components as well. Is there anything else that needs to be changed, or does this just kind of function on its own?
Couture story.
Yes, thank you through the chair to Rep. Elam. I think when we do invited testimony, that will straighten itself out, but the Department of Health does need statute change in order to reimburse Medicaid, and so they will be working to make sure that these services do qualify under Medicaid, and they need to have this legislation change in order for that to come into effect. And if I have done that, not explained that quite adequate, I'm sure that our invited testifiers will correct me on that.
So if you can follow up?
Great, that makes sense, and then and maybe this is a question for them as well. But since I have the microphone, approximately what kind of timeline will they need to do that work? Again, it probably be better deferred to the later presentation.
Yes, through the chair, I agree with that assessment.
Okay, Representative Eichheit.
Thank you, Co-Chair Himshut. Through the co-chair, it was mentioned that Alaska is one of three states that have this fairly high 50% threshold. What are the two other states?
Through the chair, Ms. Holm, could you, are you aware of those?
I'm not aware of those states.
Through the chair, perhaps our invited testifiers are. If not, we will make sure and get that information to you.
And then follow-up?
Follow-up?
Yeah, this might be better for the invited testimony, but I would be very interested in finding out some particular attribute in a young child, what a 50% developmental delay looks like and what a 25% developmental delay in the same attribute looks like, just so I can understand the concept better. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. Rep. Story, I was just kind of curious, and maybe the invited testifiers can give us a little bit more background on this, but have other states started at the 50% and then gone to the 25%? And then what kind of changes downstream have they seen? So.
Co-chair, sorry.
Thank you, Chair Hemshud. Through the chair, very good question. I'm going to see if our invited testifiers know that, and if not, I'd be happy to get that information for you.
Thank you. Sounds like we need to go to the invited testifiers. Yes. All right. I think we'll start with Neve Dardis, who is the director of the ILP program for REACH in Juneau. If you could come forward, Ms. Dardis, and introduce yourself for the record, and I think you have a presentation for us this morning, so please begin your presentation when you're ready. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Neve Dardis. I am the program director for the REACH Infant Learning Program based in Juneau, but we also serve 10 other communities throughout Southeast. I am joined on the line this morning by Heidi Haas, who is the executive director for ACCA based in Fairbanks, one of our partner programs, and then also Rich Saville from the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. I very much appreciate the opportunity to come and speak to you about this important piece of legislation this morning. HB 376 is about one question. Will Alaska support infants and toddlers at the moment when early intervention can change their entire developmental path, or only after delays have grown severe enough to meet the outdated 50% delay threshold? To put that into context, that's half a lifetime of a delay when we're talking about an infant of a toddler. We would be expecting and looking at a child at age two to be functioning at the level of a one-year-old. That is very, very significant and hard to overcome. The first 3 years of life are extraordinary. A baby's brain forms over 1 million new neural connections every second. These early years shape language, movement, social skills, emotional regulation, everything that follows. When Alaska families call ILP, they are not calling because things are fine. They're calling because they're worried and they're scared. My baby still isn't sitting. My toddler isn't talking. Something feels wrong, and I just don't know what it is. Right now, we often have to tell those families, we see the delay. We agree that there's a concern, but your child isn't delayed enough to qualify for support. HB 376 allows us to act early when the brain is most ready to change and families are most desperate for help. So what is IDEA Part C and what is ILP? So IDEA Part C is the federal commitment that families with infants and toddlers facing developmental challenges will receive early accessible support. In Alaska, that promise is carried out through our infant learning program. ILP is voluntary, family-centered, free to families, and provided in natural environments such as homes, childcare settings, community venues, tribal offices, etc. And our goal is simple: support parents to best support their children. Parents are their child's first and most important teachers. We meet them where they are, sometimes on a living room floor, sometimes in a shelter, sometimes in a remote village clinic after a long weather delay. But Alaska's current eligibility criteria, one of the most restrictive in the nation, is outdated and no longer and does not meet the needs of our citizens. That means many children with clear signs of concern are shut out of early support. HB 376 modernizes our criteria so we can serve children before delays deepen and families lose this precious time. So Alaska's ILP network is a system of 15 providers, and we are one of the most geographically expansive and committed early intervention programs in the country. Our teams are some of the most highly trained early childhood specialists and include occupational therapists, physical therapists, speech therapists, infant mental health specialists, and teachers of the deaf and hard of hearing. We serve families from Ukiavik to Metlakatla, Bethel to Copper River, Nome to Yakutat, in homes, tribal offices, health clinics, and community spaces. Our providers travel by snowplane, skiff, four-wheelers, ferry, and float planes. They sleep on gym floors or community center cots to complete evaluations. They show up during blizzards, break up in minus 40 degree days because families with developmental concerns can't wait. We currently serve over 1,800 children every year. but we evaluate many, many more who need support and cannot qualify under the 50% delay rule. These are babies with emerging signs of autism, toddlers with clear communication delays, children struggling to eat, crawl, or connect. HB 376 will allow these families to finally access support at a time when it matters most. This slide captures the heart of early childhood science. When we intervene early, outcomes improve dramatically. When we intervene late, changes grow and become more expensive to address. Nearly 90% of brain development occurs by age 3. And yet, many Alaska children with delays are not identified for special education until age 6 or even 9. By then, the window for early intervention has closed. HB 376 invests at the right time, when a child's brain is most flexible, when parents are most worried, and when intervention has the greatest return. Early intervention reduces later special education needs, lowers long-term stay costs, increases school readiness, strengthens the families, and changes developmental trajectories. This is not just compassionate policy, it is cost-effective policy. And with that, I'm going to pass the speaking over to my colleague, Rich Saville, with the Governor's Council on Special Disabilities and Special Education, to talk about some of the work and studies that brought us here.
Thank you, Richard Saville. If you could please put your name on record and continue the presentation.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemshute. My name is Richard Saville. I am the Education and Early Intervention Coordinator for the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Education. And so I want to just talk a little bit about kind of how we got to where we are today. I'm staff person for the ICC, the Interagency Coordinating Council. And so we had in meetings back in 2022 started talking about the funding gap that was starting to really become a problem and the flat funding that the program had been seeing, and how we could address that to try to help these programs get some funding back in so they can provide the services that they're required to do. And so we formed we called it a finance subcommittee to start looking at that. I mean, and in our discussions, we kind of realized that we could do better. We discovered that, you know, the 50% delay was the lowest in the country, or the highest, excuse me, in the country, the most restrictive. And we knew that we could do better. So we talked with the representative from the Alaska Mental Health Trust on the ICC. They were able to secure some funding for us for a contractor to help us dig into it. And so over the next year and a half or so, we through with the work of the contractor and myself and some other folks in the ILP and the state office, started really digging into what the country looks like for early intervention services. What are other states doing? How are they paying for it? What are some of the outcomes they're seeing? And so that all, that work resulted in a report that gets mentioned often, and it is available. And if anyone would like a copy, please let me know. I'm happy to get that to you. There are a number of recommendations made in that report, all very important. But the ones that we're focusing on today have to do with this legislation. And the first one was to align the Part C criteria with the Part B criteria in the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, the Part B being the special education requirement, eligibility requirements. And so that's, as our Representative Story discussed in her intro, that's part of what this bill does, is bring the eligibility into alignment with Alaska's Part B criteria so that kids are treated equitably across their age, not differently if they're 2 years or 3 years old. It also, one of the other recommendations in the report that's in this bill was to make changes to the Medicaid statute to ensure that state could leverage that money. Also to allow the Individual Family Services Plan to be an authorizing document for that Medicaid coverage to make things simpler for the families and the state, to so that there's just less of a more concise, easier process to deal with. Thank you, Nate. So why expand eligibility? So as we've said, Alaska has the most restrictive criteria with two other states, and those other states, although to answer the question, I don't recall off the top of my head which two we are with on 50%, but we'll look that up. But I know that they do have more expanded, they have more expanded qualifying conditions list, automatically qualifying conditions list. And so technically, because of that, we are actually last. Not that that's a great thing, but just so that we're aware. And so we knew we could do better. So that was what, you know, we wanted to, we need to do better for our kids and our families, and it will ultimately be better for the state as a whole as well. So another reason that this just is cost-effectively, financially, it's just the smart thing to do. Nobel Prize winning economist James Heckman has done a very famous study at this point, and it showed that for every dollar invested in early intervention, a state or a program, whoever it may be, can save up to $17 in future money spent for those kids and those families. So that's a massive amount, obviously. And also his study showed that 46% of children who receive early intervention don't require special education by the time they get to kindergarten. That's huge. That is a huge number of kids that don't require those very expensive additional services. And in Alaska numbers, that could save up to almost $35 million a year in cost avoidance or savings down the road. And lastly, but maybe most importantly, early intervention just improves long-term incomes for children and their families and the state. It provides enhanced developmental trajectories for the kids. They'll have better motor skills, cognitive and social emotional skills, and increased school readiness so they can be more successful in lifelong learning. It reduces the need, as I said, for special education services later. These services empower parents and families with strategies to support their children and their growth and development. And it reduces stress by providing those critical resources and interventions during the most pivotal stage of a child's life developmentally. And it will improve economic stability through parental workforce as parents are more able to return to work because their child care and developmental needs of their children are addressed earlier. And for the state, just long-term savings and reducing reliance on special education and ultimately also providing a stronger future workforce of young adults graduating from high school ready to contribute. So this next slide, the identify earlier, this is just an illustration of kids in public schools with individual education plans. And you can see the age three on the bottom, that first line, those are kids that were in the early intervention in the infant learning program that transitioned into the pre-K programs within the school. But you can see that as those up through age nine, it continues to grow. And those kids that are growing each year that are identified each year after that age three, those are the kids that this bill will identify earlier. So imagine, you know, if you're that family that Neve talked about where your child's not quite delayed enough, we can't help you at age one or two, and they go the next, say, 4 or 5 years without receiving any kinds of services, those delays are going to compound. And that means that they're not only going to be discovered later, but it's going to take a whole lot more effort and energy and resources to get those kids back up to functioning at age level. And so what we would anticipate with this curve is that instead of peaking at age nine in fourth grade, all of those kids would be found earlier. And 46% of them wouldn't even come onto this chart because, as I said earlier, James Heckman's study showed that 46% of those kids exit the infant learning programs at age level and don't require special education services. So there would be a higher number at age three, four, and five because you'd have more kids coming into transitioning from. You'd have some more kids transitioning, but then that would drop off precipitously after that. So instead of peaking at age nine, it's going to peak at, you know, age three, four, or five, and then start dropping from there. That's what we would anticipate to happen. So really could massively affect the educational system, I think.
Mr. Seville, if we could pause for just a second on this slide. I had a question from Representative Elam, and I have a question as well.
Thank you. Yes. I appreciate it. And, you know, I apologize for interrupting your thought, but this is kind of an interesting slide. And so if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly, you're talking about moving the curve of this same slide towards the lower number, which would be towards the center of the slide. Are you expecting any additional children or numbers to kind of fluctuate from there, or is it really just kind of shifting this whole curve to the younger ages?
Mr. Seville?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Elam. So that's a great question. And so, yes, so I think that we'll see two things. One, we'll see fewer children in general. So the numbers, the height of those bars will be lower to begin with, because you have 46% of kids that were identified earlier won't show up on this graph that are showing up now in ages 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, depending on when they're discovered by their schools or teachers, whoever it might be. But then also, yes, it would shift to the left. So the highest bars should be in that first, 3, 4, 5 year area, and then it should start to decline after that, as kids get up to age and then they don't need the special education services anymore.
I'm going to follow up. Oh, did you have a follow-up question?
No, not really. Go ahead.
Okay.
Thank you.
I just want to illustrate this from personal experience, and I get tearful when I talk about this. It wasn't until, I won't say the kid's name, until he was a sophomore in high school that his mom shared with me that he had been an ILP kid. That means that when I received that kid in my science classroom as a 7-year-old, I had no idea. My expectations for him were the same. They say that teachers make the same number of non-insignificant decisions per minute of teaching as a neurosurgeon practicing surgery, right? We're constantly assessing kids and figuring out how to adjust, and it's part of the classroom practice. If I know that a child is coming to me and has had delays, how I handle that child may be a little bit different. In this case, this child had had an older sister who was a high flyer, and we're not supposed to do it, but I think I just set those same assumptions, knowing that the older sister had been so grounded and so capable. So I set the same expectations for this child. He went all the way through my science room, which was second, third, fourth, and fifth grade, with me never knowing until he was a sophomore in high school that he had had services in ILP. And his mom shared it with me later, and I was just shocked because he was a high performer. But he hadn't been as a 2-year-old. So that bar for that 9-year-old would be down one and higher over on the left for that student. And then, I know another child that I found out again later had been an ILP kid. He still had an IEP when he was in my classroom, but he exited his IEP in eighth grade. So, it works. We know it works. I did have a question, though, for Mr. Seville on this slide. That precipitous drop from age 17 to 18, I am not thinking that these kids are exiting IEPs or exiting services. I'm thinking they're dropping out of our system. Can you speak to that sharp drop in those later years?
Yes. Co-Chair Himshute, thank you for that question. Yes, I think, not all kids who are on IEPs, as you know, remain in school through age 21, although some may. That's part of IDEA. So I believe that precipitous drop there from 17 to 18 are kids that are graduating that had IEPs, but they're graduating and exiting school. I wouldn't say they're dropping out of the program necessarily, but they're just graduating and moving on.
My assumption was you graduated 18, but lots of kids graduated 17. Okay, that makes sense. Thank you. Other questions? Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Seville, a question on, could you help us understand a little bit what kind of disability might not be identified until a child is 8 or 9, whereas if they entered school at age 5 on average, and then we are at least now trying to identify children in that preschool age group as well. Could you just help me understand that?
Mr. Seville?
Through the chair, Representative Schwanke, thank you for that question. I'm going to ask Heidi Haas, who's online with me, or Neve in the room there too, talk a little bit about that if they can. They are more familiar in the programs and understand the delays and disabilities more than I do.
I guess we'll just go ahead and jump over to Heidi Haas, if you could put your name on record and help us with that question.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Heidi Haas. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Center for Children and Adults. So we do host an infant learning program. I'm also the president of the Alaska Infant Learning Program Association, so thank you for the time. To the representative's question, really, I'm not in the school system, so we can gather some additional information, but I think the key to take away from this is that if delays aren't addressed early, those delays become more observable as the child gets older. So you might see reading delays, social emotional delays. You even may have some cognitive delays. There are a range of areas that are identified through Part B services that at a delay of only 25% that compound over time. And so what actually is being seen at age 9 isn't data that I've delved into deeply, but from my experience and being a parent of children who've had IEPs and being on the school board in Fairbanks, really those areas can be really diverse in that developmental delay. Children who have a diagnosis such as cerebral palsy or maybe an autism diagnosis, something that's already been identified, those aren't the kiddos that you're necessarily seeing at age 9. Those kids are probably being seen in the kindergarten, first grade years if they haven't been identified earlier.
Thank you. I just know it can take time, too. You get a five-year-old in kindergarten if they come to kindergarten, which they don't have to. So if they come to kindergarten, you're watching and you're thinking, this kid just needs a little more time to grow. And they turn 6 and they're still not making progress. And then you start thinking about, well, do we need to add support? So I think that makes sense with this graph. Representative Dibert, you had a question.
Yes, good morning, Mr. Seville, through the chair. I was wondering, I'm looking at this chart, and so when a student gets into the public school system, starts kindergarten, and needs IEP services, do you all keep track of where right now I've heard a lot that in our state it's very difficult to hire special ed teachers? Do you keep track of those numbers? Where we can service our students in the public school system? And I'm not sure if you know, I don't know if you know this answer either, because I forget. I taught third grade, but I think when I had IEP students, they were pulled out a half hour 3 times a week for services for either reading or math. But if they had reading and math, they were pulled out an hour a day. I think it just depends. That might be a harder question to answer because then you add in speech and all that.
Mr.
Seville.
Mr. Seville, can you respond?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Dibert. The first question about special education teachers, I do not know. I think the Department of Education Early Development would be the place to maybe seek that information, and I can try to find out for you. The second question, as far as where the services are provided, through IDEA, they would be provided in the least restrictive environment. And so if the services can be provided in the general education classroom, they would be. If the IEP team believes that they need to, exit the general classroom to go with a resource teacher for half an hour, hour a day, then that's what they would do. So it's very child-specific and IEP-specific for each child as to how and where and when those services are provided.
Okay. And I think that's all laid out in the individual child's plan, if they're getting speech or if they're getting reading support or whatever, and how many minutes they're supposed to get. So I think we're ready to go on. Okay, so Mr. Seville, okay. We're on slide 8.
Great, yes. So this is the last one I'll talk about, and then I'll turn it over to Heidi. So this slide just illustrates the savings that we're talking about with special education costs. So on the graph, you see at 4 years budget neutral, that just means that the amount of money you're putting into the budget that year is being recouped on the back end. The overall cost neutral at 6.5 years signifies that not only is the annual money you're putting into the budget being recouped, but also that first 3 to 4 years of money you were putting in just to kind of build the program has also been recovered. And so now after that, the savings or the cost avoidance continues to grow after that. So that's just what this graph illustrates rather nicely. I think you can see the savings just kind of explode there as time goes on. So.
Okay, thank you.
And if there are no questions on that one, I will turn it over to Heidi. Thank you.
And could you put your name on record again, please, Director Haas?
Yes. Thank you, Co-Chair Himshute. For the record, this is Heidi Haas. So I'm going to just breeze through these last couple slides, and then I have a couple of answers to some questions that I can also try and tackle. This first slide demonstrates the challenges that we face in Alaska. As you can see from the blue line, this is the grant funding that's received by programs from the state of Alaska. And the red line demonstrates the value of the dollar over time. And that information is from the Department of Labor. So while the decrease in the value of the dollar is just 18%, program costs have increased over 25% from services that were provided just as early as FY18. Recent data indicates that due to flat funding and rising costs, children enrolled in Part C services in fiscal year 24 are receiving half the amount of services than kids that were enrolled in fiscal year 11. This is because ILPs are not allowed to place eligible children on wait lists and costs have risen. So there are fewer providers with larger caseloads, and in the end, children get fewer services. Our last slide is talking about rural health transformation, as this is a question that we've been navigating over the last few months. So the Alaska Infant Learning Program Association has been active in navigating the RHTP landscape. Based on the public meetings and several smaller state staff meetings, programs have worked to find a path forward individually or as collaborative projects. The biggest struggle is equity across the state as required by federal regulations. ILP is a highly regulated program that requires all grantees to administer services within the requirements of the federal and state guidelines. Without a statewide initiative, it's been challenging for programs to plan or decide how to move forward. Potential project areas that programs have committed to dedicating themselves to are around a comprehensive approach to expanding eligibility while creating efficiencies, utilizing innovative technology, and maintaining and building a workforce that's ready to provide services. Infant learning has had a huge impact. And in the first few years of life, a child's brain forms more than 1 million new neural connections every second. Every new experience for a baby creates more connections. Using this window to help children meet developmental milestones has a positive impact on lifelong skills. Providing evidence-based early intervention and tailored services to meet a child and family's needs is a critical way to support the infants and toddlers in our state who need additional developmental support. The services are delivered to every eligible child across the state by highly qualified professionals and allows children to receive quality services in natural environments to improve their outcomes, which ultimately saves the state money in the long run. We appreciate the opportunity to present information on the Infant Learning Program and to this committee for sponsoring House Bill 376. I would recommend, if you like some light reading, to check out the early intervention report that the Governor's Council did publish. It does have a lot of great information. With that, I would take any additional questions, but I can also jump into some of the questions that were asked earlier if you'd like, Co-Chair Himshute.
I think it'd be great to get those answers. If you know them, that'd be good to have on record.
Excellent. I'm going to do my best. I was trying to keep track of them all, so if I miss one, please let me know. And I don't know that I have who asked what, so I'm just going to run through what I wrote down. The two other states that are restrictive in their eligibility are Arizona and Nevada. But they also have, as Rich mentioned, they also have other provisions that allow for more children to be identified through a diagnosed condition. So Alaska is the most restrictive in the state. There was a cost around the fiscal notes, and if the fiscal notes address all of the state, all of the needs of this. And what I would like to say to that is that the fiscal notes, although I don't see I'm not seeing fiscal notes for this bill, but I'm guessing that they're probably the same as SB 178. The fiscal notes address the state requirement in terms of what the state needs for additional staff, and then the state match for billing Medicaid. It does not address the grantee costs that are associated with expansion. So we've been pursuing the appropriation in the budget to help with those costs to get ILP expansion lifted with support to the programs that the fiscal notes don't address. The timeline, I don't have an answer for that because I think this does depend on the state's operation. So I would actually defer the timeline piece to the state, as that would be, you know, they're responsible to the Office of Special Education Services to implement all of these regulations. And so they would be the ones that would make determinations on the timeline of the rollout. There was also a question about what a 50% or 25% delay might look like. The way that I best explain it is a 50% delay looks like a two-year-old that has the skills of a one-year-old. So if you think about the difference between a one-year-old and a two-year-old, that's a 50% delay. A two-year-old that has the skills of an 18-month-old would be about a 25% delay. So the vast difference, because of the amount of development that a child has in their first few years, is it's just exponential when you look at the percentage differences. And one of the challenges that we see is that there are kids who don't qualify just before their third birthday, and then on their third birthday, they immediately qualify for Part B services once they're identified. There was also a question about states that maybe had started at 50% and gone to 25%, and if there was data on that. I do not have that information. I would have to see if there are others that might have that information within the research that was done to establish the report. Each state has had their opportunities to define what a qualifying disability or delay is. And so it probably has been that there have been states that have been higher and have lowered. And then there's probably states that have just maintained a 25 or 35% over the course of their established Part C pieces. And I guess I would ask the committee if I didn't address anyone's questions. I apologize. I think that's all I wrote down.
Those are the questions I recall, but are there other questions from the committee for Ms. Haas or for Mr. Seville or for Ms. Dardis? We'll go to Representative Schwanke.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. I'm drawing a blank. You're going to have to go
to
Rep. Eichheid.
Okay.
My apologies.
Representative Eichheid, we'll come back.
Thank you, co-chair. Through the co-chair, whoever can answer this, I'm really interested if there's any longitudinal studies that has sought to calculate a correlation between age interventions are given for folks that are identified as needing interventions. And I'm looking at slide 7 is my preference. It looks like age 9 is when a peak in terms of the number of children that are served by special education. Is there any correlation between when children receive services they need and outcomes later in life? And I guess the background behind or the context of my question is I taught 8th grade and 9th grade. Usually special education students, and they were all in my science classroom, almost everyone. They were mainstreamed. Had been identified before they reached my classroom, but I saw a variety of skills, and I also often saw frustration in my special education students because oftentimes we didn't have robust services, especially as class sizes increased. If one class I would have a special education aide, and that was it, but I had special education students throughout the day. So is there any correlation or studies that show what happens to kids who are identified later and receive services later and their ultimate outcomes as adults?
I think I'll direct that question to Mr. Seville, but we can, yeah, we can go to anyone who thinks they can answer it, I guess.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hemsheed, through Co-Chair to Representative Aishid. I'm not aware of any studies that specifically look at that, although, but I'm happy to try to see if I can find any. I would say just, you know, logically speaking, that the sooner a delay is identified and addressed, the better. Delays will compound over time if they're not not discovered early. So the 25% delay in a two-year-old that's not addressed is a much higher percent delay in the eight-year-old when it is discovered, although there's no study that I'm aware of that would prove that out. But I do believe, just logically thinking it through, that those kids who have those interventions earlier would, generally speaking, have better outcomes, future outcomes, than those who those delays are discovered later.
Follow up? It's mostly a comment. I appreciate that. You know, I'm a science person, so we have our hypotheses, but unless they're informed by data, I don't want to call them anything more than hypotheses. But, you know, we have our READS Act, and that really focuses attention K through 3, and, you know, students can be held back, and it seems to me, as somebody who taught older kids that sometimes didn't know how to read in eighth and ninth grade, with our READS Act and our priority on accountability, the sooner we can give interventions, 0 to 3, as you said, it seems to make a lot of sense, literally and figuratively.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that comment. We'll move over to Representative Elam.
Thank you. I appreciate the presentation. I guess I have kind of a two-part question. A lot of the early intervention and sort of detection, I guess, is very heavily dependent on parenting and parental participation. And so I'm wondering, of the children that qualify for these services, or maybe the ones that don't qualify, do we know what percentage of those children have parents or are in, say, you know, like programs like OCS or, you know, some of the other areas of our communities that, you know, trying to be sensitive about how I address this question, but maybe where parents really just aren't there. And then also the other question I have is how are we communicating out to families and, you know, early parents, first-time parents, that here are things that you kind of want to be watching for, because a lot of stuff, you know, goes undetected for a long time.
I'm not sure. Can that go to maybe Ms. Dardis?
Sure, yes.
Yeah, I'm thinking child find and that kind of thing.
Yes, yeah. Correct. Through the chair, Representative Elams. So our infant learning programs tailor outreach specific to the communities that they operate in. So we work with physicians' offices, we work with our local school districts, we work with NICUs, we partner with childcare centers, we participate in community health fairs, we have one program. I know I've heard stories where they meet people getting off planes at the airport, knowing that they're either like heading out or returning from medical visits in Anchorage, etc. And so they time flights and watch out for young families disembarking. So what we do is we really just try to be responsive to the unique needs and the demographics in each specific community. And to speak to our interaction with families, we absolutely see parents as a child's first and most valuable teacher and continue to serve that role throughout a child's lifespan. And so we place a lot of emphasis on our highly skilled professionals engaging in like infant mental health trainings. We engage with social workers if we're feeling like we have a family that are challenging to engage, or we're just not feeling like that connection is there, or a breakthrough, we're not seeing follow through. We will reach out and connect to other resources in the community as well, because our priority is to make sure that that child has the best support available to them. And it's like we work with children through the parents. We do interface a lot with the Office of Children's Services. There is actually an automated referral system in place between OCS's ORCID database and the Infant Learning Program database held in Department of Health. And so when a case is substantiated within an instance of a child under the age of three, an ILP program for whatever region that child is located in is automatically notified that there's a child, that there's an OCS case that has been substantiated. And so in that, then we will reach out to the Office of Children's Services. We'll reach out to, if the child is still with the biological parents, we'll reach out to them. Or we work pretty intensively with a lot of foster parents throughout the state. And we also recognize that, that is, of course, another area and a department that is struggling. And so ILP does all that we can to provide complementary supports to bolster foster parents across the state of Alaska. Of course, though, our program is voluntary. And so, families, there are times where they say, we don't see the delay that other people are concerned about, or, there may be reasons, especially if they have had some interfacing with the Office of Children's Services, where there's maybe just a distrust of systems, or, some fear about having some more eyes on that child. But, we have a lot of strategies. We offer, many programs offer like play groups and different things like that. And so oftentimes, instead of saying, well, our first interaction should be, let's come to your home and let's evaluate your child, it's like, okay, that's fine. If you're not interested at this time, then maybe you would like to come to our community play group. And we have kind of different strategies like that can kind of help us have eyes on kids and, build a relationship with families so that they do feel that they're at a point where they can truly engage with us.
Let me follow up.
A quick follow up.
Yes, thank you. And kind of focusing in more on the OCS line of things, when there is a child who doesn't have an advocate, who is that advocate?
Ms. Starnes.
I guess I'm having a hard time understanding the question.
It may not be as applicable to this particular section, but like, we have a lot of children that get sort of lost in the OCS system, mm-hmm. and they don't necessarily have the same level of advocacy. Personally, I had two children that went through speech-related issues, and it required a tremendous amount of parental advocacy. And so there are a lot of children out there that don't necessarily have that, and I guess I'm just bringing awareness to maybe some of that. But then if you had information on it, it would be – interesting to see how it correlated to some of the data that we were also seeing.
Yeah, through the chair.
Thank you.
Actually for the last 4 years, four programs, infant learning programs, received funding from the Alaska Mental Health Trust to specifically heighten our outreach and engagement with children in the foster care system, or also just families or children identified as high risk, not necessarily solely, already involved in the OCS system. And so I don't have the data top of mind, but I think I could probably certainly reach out. My program was one of those. The program I work with was one of the programs that received that funding. And so we definitely have some information about the percentage of children that enroll with us that have had OCS involvement or would be classified as like high risk versus kind of the more general population of referrals. But we too do see that, I think we all can acknowledge that in all facets, like children do sadly fall through the cracks. And so, with legislation such as this, it allows providers to refer more children to us. Like we have a lot of like physicians that, know that the threshold is 50% delay and will hold off on referral because they don't want to waste the family's time essentially. And different avenues like that, because we do a great deal of outreach, but it's always with the caveat of, but we can only serve you if the child is 50% delayed. And so there are a lot of children out there that never receive an evaluation even to determine that there's a 30% delay, because the community physicians, our community partners, are aware of how high that threshold is.
Which then leads to a data gap as to the necessity of doing this.
And I've seen a lot of that. Yeah. So, but thank you.
Okay. Representative Dybert and then Representative Underwood.
Yes, through the co-chair, Ms. Dardis, I don't know if you know the answer to this or if I might have missed it in the presentation. How many children are on your IOP list that you're serving, and what's the average caseload of per provider? Thanks.
And this, so are you asking Rep. Dybert for a statewide number?
Through the co-chair, do you have a wait list? Do you, how many children are you serving?
Okay, we'll go there.
Okay, through the chair. So ILPs are not allowed to have wait lists. We are statutorily required to conduct an intake and complete a developmental evaluation and determine whether a child will enroll or not enroll, or that the family make that choice, within 45 days of us receiving that referral. So there are no wait lists in any programs across the state. And then annually we serve approximately just over 1,800 children on average every single year across the state that enroll.
And I'll just point to the, on slide 9, the flat funding, really for more than a decade, basically there's been flat funding, so then you're not able to hire additional staff, so
correct,
you have to work with the staff you have,
correct,
with a potentially increasing number of cases. So did you have a follow-up, Dybert?
I did.
I'm so sorry.
Okay, I think I did. Yeah. I was looking at the graph on page 7. Sorry, through the co-chair.
No, you're all good. I interrupted.
To Ms. Dardis. Yeah, I was looking at slide 7 and just the numbers began at age 3 and you serve 0 through 3. So I was just wondering what those numbers look like. And 1,800 gives me a high-level snapshot. And it'd be interesting. The reason why I asked is because I got to speak to a high school last fall and spoke with the SPED teacher, and their caseloads were around 60 to 65, I believe, per one provider at a high school, which you just think about the paperwork and the work that goes to servicing 65 for one person. So that's why I asked that. Thanks.
Did you want to respond to that, Mr.?
I certainly can, through the chair. Thank you so much. So to speak to caseload size, it varies program to program, but I would hazard a guess that the average caseload is like 25 children or higher than that. And with that, just to acknowledge that we see children in natural environments, and so things we have to consider about like travel time to and from a family's home or a community venue, things like that. So whilst, you know, 25 children in the scheme of looking at a classroom size or some other avenues may not on the face of it seem that large, just with, for the administrative burden and then our ability to see those children on a regular basis, including like village travel, etc., those caseloads are very, very high.
Okay, Representative Underwood.
Thank you. Through the chair, I just kind of have more of a comment than a question. Just from personal experience, about a decade ago, I worked in a therapy office, and this wasn't like ILP specific, but we did pediatrics. And in the MATSU, I was like, how are we going to fill all of these slots? It was speech, OT, PT. We had adults, but we had a giant pediatrics spot. We always had sometimes up to 2-year wait list for people getting in. It was just like mind-blowing to me. And then, of course, you know, this was unbeknownst to me until I worked in this sector where I thought, how are they going to work with babies? And what's that? But you see it like day in and day out. And we had multiple therapists. And, I mean, they're extremely qualified at what they do. They could do one appointment and they could just notice what's going on. You know, this is what they do. It's just like being a doctor's office day in and day out. But in that realm, we actually had quite a bit of foster parents that were engaged. And from my experience, it's because when they were taking in children like this, there was a lot of that engagement with programs like this that were given to them that actually parents, I felt, didn't know, biological parents necessarily weren't as aware of some of these, unless their physician or somebody is telling them about that. That was my experience. And so I feel like you could see the disheartened demeanor with our therapist when they knew that they couldn't give that 25% and had to do the 50%, because some of them were like, if I could just have this kiddo for even just a few months, then we could course correct the way that they were going. And it is a giant cost savings, not to look at children as dollars, but we're talking about how can we save money in this state. Like, if you invest in this type of activity up front, just like anything else, you exercise, you take care of your body, you're going to have a cost savings down the road. And so, I mean, I just seen it firsthand for about 5 years, and it was mind-blowing just in my own community. The need is so great for these services. And so looking at our school districts and ways that we can, you know, cost and put money towards the classroom and teachers and retention, all that stuff, I think of programs like this that could offset a lot of that in the early intervention stages. So I just wanted to put that out there just from my own experience seeing it firsthand.
Thank you so much for that comment. We're going to take one final question from Representative Schwanke.
Thank you.
We're not
chair.
Quite done with this bill, but we'll
okay.
move on.
I'll try to be quick. I do have two questions. My first question is, do we know how the original appropriation was developed? Because the initial statement was that the funding has been flat for many years. So I was very curious about that initially and how that number came about. And then my second question is, what does the continuum of care look like from ILP into schools? And is there that connection? Because Rep. Himshute noted not knowing. And so is there a required connection when a child enters school?
Start us.
Through the chair, I will probably ask Rich to speak to the appropriation or Heidi, but I can certainly speak to that continuum. So at 33 months, the infant learning program, or prior to, but certainly by 33 months at the latest, infant learning programs begin a formalized transition process with local school districts to ensure that a child is evaluated by a school district and has an IEP in place by age 3. At that point, though, once the child does enroll in a school district, and again, enrolling in the school district is a parent's choice, it's not mandated by ILP, once the child is age 3 and has transitioned into the school district, ILP is no longer involved with that family. We would also, in addition to connecting them with school districts, we also make sure that if they do need continued outpatient therapy, etc., or other social service resources, that we do connect them with those prior to exiting our program. But we are not, we do not formally stay involved or follow children beyond age 3.
And I think the other question was going to go to Mr. Seville online about the, pardon me, the flat funding question. And I'll just add, the student where I didn't know that he'd been served by ILP did not have an IEP. So, or he may have had earlier, but once a child exits their IEP, I have no need to know, in theory. So, Mr. Seville.
Thank you, through the co-chair, Representative Schwanke. I don't have an answer to that, but if Pam Burton is still online, she may with the state office. I would defer to the state to answer that about the original appropriation.
Pamela Burton, if you're online, could you unmute yourself, put your name on the record, and help us with that question?
Yes, hi, through the chair. For the record, my name is Pamela Burton. I am a health program manager with the Department of Health, Senior and Disabilities. as far as the appropriation, I'm not quite sure of the question. I can tell you that we have received state general funds, and we also receive federal Part C grant funds, and both of those amounts have been the same for at least the last decade that I'm aware of.
Follow-up?
I'm not sure if that answered the question.
Mm-hmm. Follow-up?
Yeah, thank you for that. I didn't mean to put you guys on the spot, but I would like to know what the history of that particular appropriation amount was, specifically why it was set the way that it was, and what kind of impacts that it had when it went into effect.
We can try to get those answers for you, I think, from the department. And I just want to point out, I think some funds were added last year and then were not sustained. We're lost through veto. So I wanted to note also the fiscal notes that one of the testifiers wasn't able to find have not yet been posted to BASIS. They are available in hard copy outside the door, and we will get them up on BASIS as soon as we conclude the meeting today. And then Courtney Enright from the Department of Health, our liaison, I think can speak to the Medicaid implementation timeline. So if you don't mind, Ms. Enright, I'd like to take the time since you're here to get some more information on that. Welcome.
Good morning. Courtney Enright, Legislative Liaison for the Department of Health. Through the chair, Representative Elam. So what will drive the timeline for implementation is what it will take to negotiate with the federal government to implement these services into our Medicaid program. This will likely take what's called a state plan amendment. The state plan is the document that governs, you know, what services we cover between the state and federal government in our Medicaid program. It will require us to go through establishing a rate methodology, regulations, and tribal consultation. Typically, we look at 18 to 24 months for a full implementation of a state plan amendment of this effect. Can take a little longer, can take a little bit shorter time, just kind of depends on, you know, all of these particular processes can be stopped at different times by the federal government, and we have specific timelines that we have to follow accordingly.
Representative Elam.
Thank you, and just a little follow-up. I appreciate the information. Does this potentially allow us to have greater opportunities for services as far as providers being able to provide these services? I love what the Infant Learning Program does, but there's a lot of services that a lot of service providers out there who sort of avoid the whole program because of the complexities of some of these things.
So through the chair, Representative Elam, effectively, like any service in the Medicaid program, if this is rolled in as a Medicaid service, any provider that's enrolled in Medicaid that has the qualifications to provide these services could then provide them for individuals that are qualified.
If I may follow up? Mm-hmm. Follow up. Would we be looking at maybe making some of the processes a little simpler or more provider friendly so that they would be encouraged to jump in?
So through the chair, Representative Elam, there's completely different processes when we talk about what's going on in a grant program versus in Medicaid. So I think simpler is in the eye of the beholder. If you're more comfortable navigating the Medicaid program, you probably view this as more simple. If you're more comfortable with the grant process, it's what you know is probably going to be simpler. But we do offer a variety of technical assistance to providers to try to help them navigate the process. So.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee for Ms. Enright? I did want to circle back to the RHTP. And just if you are able to provide, it's on page 10 on the slides, any kind of, what is the opportunity here under RHTP and what kind of timelines are we looking at?
So to the chair, the Rural Health Transformation Program, we are currently in the process of evaluating our letters of interest to kind of determine where our buckets are available. I think the challenge with the Infant Learning Program has been sustainability, right? So one of the requirements for the Rural Health Transformation Program has been there has to be a sustainable funding source. In some ways, integrating it into the Medicaid program can address that element because it's a commitment on the state's half to fund in a longer term process. But without that, it is a challenge in the Infant Learning Program because we have to have some sort of sustainable funding plan in order to qualify for Rural Health Transformation Program funds.
Right, makes sense. Okay. I just want to point out it feels like we have general alignment within the committee that this is a program that works. So then comes the next step. What's our commitment to that? So when we find something that works, what do we do with that? So, okay, we did notice public testimony, and I'd like to move on to public testimony if there are no more committee questions. You guys have been great this morning. Okay, so with that in mind, we are going to open public testimony on House Bill. I don't even know what we're on. House Bill 376. And I don't see anyone in the room wishing to testify, but we have some folks online. So we're going to go to, just making sure here, we're going to go to Chelsea Burke in Anchorage, and after Chelsea, we'll hear from Tara Pike. So Chelsea, if you could put your name on the record and share your thoughts with us, welcome.
Good morning, members of the House Education Committee. For the record, my name is Chelsea Burke. I live in Eagle River. I am the parent of four teenage boys in the Anchorage School District, the youngest of which has a developmental disability. It is important to state I am a state employee, but taking personal leave currently to give my personal testimony in strong support of HB 376, which expands eligibility for Alaska's infant learning program and increases funding to support that expansion. My youngest son began receiving early intervention services before age two. At the time, we were living in Delta Junction, Alaska, and using childcare at Fort Greeley. Through the infant learning program, he received itinerant services directly within his childcare setting. That flexibility allowed both parents to remain in the workforce while ensuring consistency in his therapies, both supporting with us parents at home and within his childcare program. Early intervention led to his diagnosis and helped transition him smoothly into preschool and eventually school-age services. Today, he is almost 14. He is a Special Olympic athlete and anxious to start high school at Chidiac High this fall. He is independent, communicative, and thriving. He still needs special education support, but far less than he once did. And he no longer requires additional therapies outside of school. He requires fewer behavioral interventions, less supervision, and can clearly communicate his needs, dramatically reducing frustration and previous aggression. And ultimately, the cost of the school district has declined. I attribute that progress directly to early intervention services received through ILP. This bill is compassionate, but it is also fiscally responsible. Early intervention strengthens families, supports their workforce participation, and reduces long-term costs in special education and Medicaid. As a parent who has lived this, I can say with certainty, early intervention changes trajectories. I respectfully urge you to support HB 376. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll go now to Tara Pike in Wasilla, and after that, Jack Day. Tara, if you could introduce yourself and begin your testimony, please.
My name is Tara Pike. I am calling in support of House Bill 376. I respectfully urge the committee to support this bill. I am a biological mother, an adoptive mother, and a foster mother who has relied on the infant learning program to support the children in our family. Through this program, our family received support during critical developmental stages that truly changed the trajectory of our children. By expanding the eligibility from 50% developmental delay to 25% delay, it will allow for more Alaskan families to access early intervention when it matters the most, no matter where they live in our state. While we understand the budget is tight, investing early in children saves money in the long run. Nearly half of the children who receive early intervention services will not require higher cost special education services later in the K-12 system. A small investment early can change the entire future of a child. Please support HB 376. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I see that Jack Day is no longer available. I see also Amy Simpson online. I'm wondering if you were hoping to testify today. If so, please put your name on record and share your thoughts with us.
Hello, good morning. My name is Amy Simpson. I am the Executive Director for Programs for Infants and Children in Anchorage. And I am going to share Jack Day's story. He is a parent of a child with special needs, and it's especially important in that he started trying to seek services for his child when his child was 18 months old, and he didn't qualify for Part C services in Alaska. His family then moved to another state, and he was found eligible and received early intervention services through another state and has then since come back to Alaska. And his story is so important because it's one that we experience every day when we provide evaluations to children and families. And when we have to tell a parent that we are worried about their child's development, they were right to seek an evaluation to find out how they're doing. However, they are not yet behind enough for Alaska infant learning programs to serve them is a really difficult conversation, because we know in some communities that means they won't get services at all. In other communities, they face, if they seek therapy services, that they'll experience long wait lists for the help of a speech therapist, occupational therapist, or physical therapist. And you know, House Bill 376 will allow these families to access services no matter where they are in the state to help their children thrive and grow. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, seeing no one else online and no one else in the room, we're going to close public testimony. Co-Chair Story, did you want to make closing comments on this bill today?
Yes, I wanted to thank the committee for hearing this bill, for sponsoring the committee substitute, for all the good questions today, and I wanted to thank the invited testifiers online. So obviously, everyone cares deeply about our children in this state and wants to give them a good start. I wanted to make sure that I noted there were a couple of reports referenced today. I will make sure that you get those reports. One was the recommendation to expand eligibility and funding for the Alaska Infant Learning Program. We will make sure we get that out in an email today. And then another was referenced from the Governor's Council, and I'm not remembering the name of that report, but I will get that report to you. And then I also wanted to say that this is the companion bill to Senate. I'd mentioned that before, Health and Social Services Committee, and there were quite a few letters of support in that document, and I'm going to submit those to you too and have them all posted on BASIS, of course, because I think there was some valuable information in that from some of the questions that were asked today. So thank you. I think what's always hard that we face in our work is prioritization and to fund up front, knowing that there will be savings later. We struggle with that. And I also wanted to say I think about this when I think about we want evaluations a lot. And I remember as a school board member, we were wanting to do evaluations when we opened up our second high school, Thunder Mountain. What does it look like having two compared to one? And we had to, at that time, and that was actually at least 26 years ago, 2000 is just crazy to me how time flies. But to do an evaluation, we had to pay for it every year. We did it through the University of Alaska Fairbanks. It was $30,000, and we did not want to do the evaluation. We had not, the budgets were so tight. And that was, you know, quite a bit. But every data we want to do and collect in the social services field, scientific field, whatever, it costs money to do a truly representative sample, things like that. And fortunately, there's not a lot of data and research out there on many different things because it is expensive to do that. So I just wanted to mention that. I'm happy to try and answer any further questions. Again, thank you for the thorough vetting that you gave the bill today.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Story. And we're going to set an amendment deadline for this bill for Monday, March 23rd at 5 p.m. Please submit all amendments to my office by that time. And thank you so much for your time this morning and to your staff, Ms. Holm. And we are now going to take up our next order of business, which is House Bill 358, sponsored by Representative Elam, entitled An Act Establishing the Career and Technical Education Mobility Grant Program relating to pre-apprenticeship and work-based learning opportunities for secondary school students and providing for an effective date. We previously heard invited and public testimony on this bill. Representative Elam, can you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and give us any additional information you'd like us to have?
Thank you. Bill Elam, Representative for House District 8. I appreciate this opportunity to come back before the body here to talk about House Bill 358. I will be concise. We really didn't have a lot of follow-up as far as additional information. Definitely had a significant amount of districts that reached out and just, you know, were appreciative of the bill and the concept, but nothing else really to add for the conversation here today.
Okay. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Story.
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, thank you, Rep. Elam, for bringing this forward. I know that career and tech education is so important to keeping kids in school, to making them feel like they belong, and helps their outcomes. I was looking at the fiscal notes and trying to understand them a little bit better. It says that the department will have, I can't remember, one education specialist, and that is the, and then some services. So that is the total. But I was trying to understand how it works financially, because that's the department's plan. But then how I think this works is this is a career and technical education mobility grant. And so who pays for the students to attend a certain CTE program that is not in their district? And I assume that they need to somehow have transportation to get there. I don't know if it's I don't know if room or board, if a person needs to chaperone them when they're traveling or driving there, just some of those logistics. And then the communities who are hosting the student, obviously in CTE classes there is a limited number of students who can take it, because, you know, welding, you can only have so many people in a welding program. And cost to the community. Anyway, if you could help me visualize a little bit, and should there be grant money going along with this bill to help pay for some of those costs?
Representative Vila.
Thank you, and to the co-chairs. I mean, that's a great question. And so the fiscal note that this particular bill brings is for the administration of the grant program. It would, if you kind of dig through the verbiage in the bill, you'll find that it's subject to appropriations. And so as a body, we would have to appropriate funding for this grant program. And so that would be a component of it. So if we decided we wanted to put X dollars for CTE grants, we would do that in the budgeting process. And so as far as administering the programs, as a state, we generally defer to local control with a lot of our district choices on how they would transport students. But whenever I think of it, I tend to think of it kind of like sports, right? We have children that go all over the state for youth sport programs, and they have lodging and travel. And so it would be similar, but run through a grant program. And so you pointed out earlier that you can only put so many students in a program. The other side of that is you have to have so many programs to make a program, or so many students to make a program viable. And so in small communities, a lot of times they don't put large, you know, outboard repair shops together, because they don't have the student base to work on, say, a Yamaha outboard, for example. But in my school district, we do. And so we put on those programs and workshops. And so a district in, say, Western Alaska, for example, maybe they have three or four communities. They've got cohorts throughout some of the more remote and rural areas. That cohort would put together a group of students from, say, you know, three students from community A, three students from community B, three students from community C, nine students, bring them to the peninsula. And then this allows the grant to be able to provide dollars to the sending and the hosting. So it respects district boundaries, but allows the collaboration to be able to host those kinds of events. One of the ones that come to mind in my school district in particular is Whittier, right? You know, they're part of Anchorage. Right, you would think that Anchorage would be able to host a pretty cool program, but we've got a really cool program on the peninsula for our CNAs and some of our medical assistants. We've got a lot of community relationship between our healthcare system on the peninsula and the community just in general. So we're able to support that. And so we've had Whittier students ask to participate in Kenai Peninsula, but then how do you make this funding work? And so this connects a lot of those dots while still respecting the communities and how they send and receive. But it does prioritize funding through DEED for those programs where they're doing that hosting and sending. And then it also prioritizes it for rural and remote communities as well.
So that's basically an aspirational bill, just like the fire hall bill that's on the move from the Senate, setting up a framework. If someday the state has funding, we could do this. We don't have to wait to set up the program. We've got the program. Now we have the money.
Through the chair, in my opinion, it could be more than an aspiration. It could be a prioritization. Depends on how we want to spend our money.
Okay. Follow up, Representative Story?
Yes. Thank you. I had a few questions through the chair, if I might. You've talked about these are going to be performance grants within the presentation. How do you envisionize that working?
Through the chair or to the co-chairs? DEED is going to be, you know, very involved with seeing that kind of participation, right? And so how I envision seeing the performance is, you know, are we seeing better or engagement with our students? Are we seeing, you know, better outcomes academically through certifications, through participation? And really, engagement is kind of one of the things I'm looking for. So I think of this as kind of the carrot side of some of those absenteeisms that we were seeing, right? You know, if you want to go to school because you're working on, you saw the girls in welding program that our colleagues to the north were putting on. Those girls were very engaged, right? You know, and you see that throughout their academic career. And so my hope is that we would, as a group, see that and value that engagement, and that would be part of the performance we'd be looking for.
Follow up. So it says, through the chair to Rep. Elam, it says HB 358 prioritizes measurable outcomes, ensuring that funding is directed towards programs that produce skilled graduates ready for the workforce. So you visualize DEED kind of having a rubric, looking at the different programs offered, seeing how many of those kids are successful in getting a certification, and then those programs would be prioritized to receive the grants versus those that are just starting up who want to do CTE, or if you could elaborate on that.
Rep. Elam?
Yeah. So as far as prioritizing the programs, you know, once you getting something kicked off, we're going to have to kind of see how it starts and where we go. A rubric would be a wonderful way to be able to measure some of that. You gave a couple of examples there. Can you restate the question again? I don't know that I'm answering you very well.
Thank you. Yes. Through the chair, perhaps it'd be interesting to have the Department of Health or whoever helps you with the fiscal notes, sort of how they visualize doing it. But really my questions were, how are they going to prioritize? Will they be looking at which programs currently have certifications, what programs, you know, are happening, and will they have a rubric for deciding who will get the grants?
I'm going to jump in. This might be page 7, line 24. I also had a question. It says it uses the word prioritize award funding. Am I in the right place?
I'm looking for that particular. On the bill. Yeah.
Yeah. If insufficient money is appropriated, is that? Because I don't know if I might be asking the same question, but I was concerned. If insufficient money, it says on page 7, starting at line 23, if insufficient money is appropriated to fully fund the program, the department shall prioritize awarding funding. I think you were asking more about evaluation. So I jumped in. Maybe I took us to the wrong place.
That's okay, Chair Hemshed. I find that it's appropriate. I wasn't asking so much about evaluation at that time, but, like, how do we assess who shall get the programs? And it also, I had a follow-up question with that is, like, when we have wait lists, which I can assume happening, we have a statute that says they must be random in nature, and your bill prioritizes remote and rural at one of the levels of funding. And I know, because I think many of us have received on other things with LegisLegal, when we don't have something that's equalized, they often say if it's on the record and there's clear reasons why a program should happen, and you can justify it, that is something to take into account. But I can have you gotten a note from LegisLegal saying that this could be discriminatory, having to, if there was wait lists and they have to go to randomized drawing.
Through the chair, not that I recall, there was no yellow flags or anything called out on this, and so we would need some participation from DEED in how we would, you know, prioritize some of these fundings for the programs, and basically the instruction here, in my opinion, is that it tries to prioritize. So let's say you put $1 million into it, right? And, well, we have – I mean, it's easy to go through that kind of money in one of the community – or in these programs. And so what the intent is to prioritize the programs that are being, you know, successful, but then also not diminish the fact that, you know, our rural and remote communities – need to be supported to be able to participate in some of the larger programs. So, you know, so that's really kind of what the intent is here.
I'm going to stop us for just a second and take a really quick at ease. Okay, we're back on the record here. Co-Chair Story.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair and to the committee and to Rep Elam. Perhaps we should also have the Department of Labor come to the next meeting, too, because they are referenced in this grant, and I think it would be helpful to kind of do the work and see how everything could be pieced together. So I would appreciate if that is a possibility. And I think what I would be important to note at some point, like, who decides who can attend? Because CTE is really popular, and I can imagine there are people getting excited and involved right away. And so I think it would be important I would like to hear from DEED or Department of Labor how they would be prioritized, how they see that situation. And then if I may, one other.
Of course.
I think this is such a great opportunity because CTE is, you know, important to all of us. It would be helpful to me and your invited testifiers that you had come the first time. I would love to see kind of like, and this might be too much work, but a CTE map where we, and I think some of them are provided, where we have certain places where they've got some good CTE programs, and if we have any deserts out there where we see some districts not having any access to CTE at all, and those districts might be the ones who might want to take advantage of some of the grants that you're talking about. But I think it would be helpful that if we really have a clear picture of where CTE is across the state, what's being offered.
I think it could be tricky because there's like 16 different identified CTE pathways, but also Sea Alaska Heritage is really looking to cultural arts as a CTE. You know, so now it's not just the 16 CNA and culinary and welding, and now we're also looking at cultural arts being considered a CTE pathway. And so finding those deserts, it's a big job, but we need it. We need to know who's not getting these services. So I don't know if that's on you or if somebody, like you said, Co-Chair Story, maybe one of the testifiers that you had invited testimony would know that. But it would be really great to know who has what and where are things missing. Co-Chair Story.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Himshut, to the committee. And that might be just something that we have a CTE day on our committee as an informational topic as we go along this session. Anyway, but I bring that forward. I think particularly we do have some legislation still in flux having to do with funding for if we pass the multi-state tax compact, there would be funding for CTE and the READS Act. And I think it would just be helpful for us to know the situation, have a clearer picture. So it could be done through a committee work, but also if there's anything that you feel would enhance us understanding of the CTE situation and how your grant program would work, I would appreciate that.
Representative Elam.
Thank you. All very great points. I guess kind of going back to one of the things, part of the intent is to try to make it a win-win for all of the districts, right? The smaller ones that maybe can't afford the investment into the programs. A lot of these programs tend to be pretty capital intense, but then also kind of a win for the districts who have made that capital investment so that, you know, they can do that. And so that's why that prioritization language is in there, is to try to make it a win-win for all of the different districts. But yeah, I think this sounds great—a CTE day or trying to figure out how we can find out where the gaps are. I think those are all really important topics to have, and so we'll work to see what we can do to maybe provide a better presentation for some of those areas.
I think our offices might be willing to work with you, and one thing that I often ask myself is, who has which equipment even? And I think we've had that conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm so concerned about some of the older equipment that I've seen around my district. Yes, they have these wonderful woodworking materials, but now you buy these new materials and there's a little sensor, and if your hand is anywhere near a moving part that it shouldn't be, it turns the machine off. And so what's the condition? And that's way deeper than what your bill is trying to get at. But CTE is a little bit in a shambles across our state, and yet great things. It's like a phoenix coming out of the ashes with some of the great stuff we're seeing around the state. So you've hit on a really important topic.
Thank you.
I'll be quick. One really tiny mini question quickly from Representative Schwanke.
Thank you, through the chair. I just want to thank you for bringing the bill forward. And I just wanted to put on the record, one of the things that people don't realize is that our Carl Perkins grant, it's a federal grant, is something that districts have relied on for a lot of years, but it's been stable in funding for many, many years. And one of the things that we're starting to see, CTE is very broad, career and technical. Like it is extremely broad to help our kids figure out how to connect their K-12 education with an actual career, or after graduation, what's their next step. So I just wanted to say thank you, and we're starting to see some really tremendous sharing opportunities between our small districts to expose kids to career pathways and technical expertise that exist in one small district that don't exist in another small district. So this is a way for our small districts to really figure out how to capitalize on that success in different areas. So thank you.
And I'll just say, we see it already happening. Some of the small districts that are, there's four districts in BBRCTE, so they're already identifying the need that you've identified, working to solve it, so maybe these things can come together. So, okay. Thank you. Sorry, we're not going to get through it today, but there's a lot more to talk about, so thanks for your time. This is going to conclude our meeting for today. Our next meeting is this Wednesday, March 18th at 8 a.m. in this room, Davis 106. We will hear from the governor's appointees for the State Board of Education. Appointees' information, including resumes, will be posted to BASIS and sent to committee members. Next, we will have an introductory hearing on Senate Bill 23, sponsored by Senator Stevens. If time allows, we will hear bills previously heard. As a reminder, the committee's email address is house.education@akleg.gov. Public testimony can be sent to this address. Seeing no further business before the committee, the meeting is adjourned at 9:57 a.m.